two, three, four.
And then five, six, seven, eight.
Got what?
Five, six, seven, eight.
Five, six, seven, eight. Five, six, seven, eight.
Okay.
Oh, you're on beta three. We're talking about when the cats met on October 25th near Beaver Creek. Andrew McMeekin, who was CEO of A Company and who was present at the incident or occasion, declares that it was at least 12 miles beyond Beaver Creek. I've had everything from 7 to 12 miles. In any case, it wouldn't be very far from where the Snag Road today takes off from the main Alaska Highway. That's about 14 miles beyond Beaver Creek. And Charles and I videotaped that area this summer. When the cats met, according to the record I've got, Andrew McMeekin was there. Well, I don't think McMeekin was present when the cats actually met, but he came up. But George Jones, Lieutenant George Jones, who was attached to A Company, was present with the Fine Sims when the cats met. And there was a lieutenant from the 87th, the 18th Engineers there, and with their cat driver, who was a private, Lutzka, from Texas, Kennedy, Texas. Anyway, they met, and Harold Richardson came up shortly afterwards with several officers of May Company and took the famous picture of the two cat drivers shaking hands over the blades of their cats. After that, there was to be a picture of all the officers present, and it had long been planned that I deserved a place for this occasion, and I wrote Janet that night that the cats had met. I wasn't present at the occasion because I was way back up the line, about five or several miles from Beaver Creek, repairing a cat, trying to keep punching the trail so we could make this occasion take place, so I didn't get to it. Anyway, they held the picture of the officers up for about an hour, waiting for me to come, and when I didn't get there, well, they went ahead and took the picture. And that is the second picture. Now, I showed that last night, and I'll give you a copy of it before I leave here. I had never seen that picture until recently, and it came from Walter Parsons in Texas. Sent a copy to Jim Coleman, and Jim Coleman distributed it to several other people, me and McMeekin and several others. And it says that this was about 4:30. The cats must have met around 3 o'clock or something like that. But the point I want to make in all this is that there's a whole group of A Company officers present, including Major Waite, who had been made temporary battalion commander of the 1st Battalion while Major Mitchum was out front locating the road. And there's only one officer there from the 18th Engineers, along with their cat driver, along with the 97th officers who were present. There's Bloom, who was a representative of the Caterpillar Company, who had been with us on the entire job. He's the only civilian present. And Richardson certified that outside of the group shown in this picture, when this picture was made, except for the enlisted men, and I'm not even sure they were there at that time, there were no other people present. I'm going to give you a copy of this. And it's right out of the National Archives. Really. And the point I want to make is that the 97th was building a road right on down past Beaver Creek. The 18th had put a small detachment across the White River to come and find the 97th. And it was said at the time, and I've heard it from other records since, that the 18th cat was way back, maybe 5 miles, I don't know, and they heard a cat running up ahead. So instead of making road or clearing trail, they just took off the officer, this lieutenant, and Lutzka, his cat driver, took off cross country to find the 97th cat. And the 97th was George Jones and the Fine Sims were very surprised when suddenly an 18th engineer cat showed up. There's been a lot. This alone proves that the incident took place farther than Beaver Creek, as far as I'm concerned. There's also been a lot of discussion, and Colonel Pauley didn't do it any good. Colonel Pauley was the original CO of the 18th Engineers. And after General Hogue left, and then someone else took over the northern sector. General Hogue, you know who he was. And another officer, you can get that out of Heath Twitchell's books. He's done a lot of research on that. And Colonel Pauley at this time was in charge of the northern sector from White Horse all the way through the 97th, well, all the way to Delta, because he was over the contractors too. In a paper which let you get a copy of, which is a letter written by Colonel Pauley to General Sturtevant, who was Assistant Chief Engineers, right after this, he gives absolutely no credit to the 97th Engineers for having done anything on the building of the road. It was really a winter trail. It was so frozen so hard we couldn't build much road. But he gives no credit to the 97th Engineers for working beyond Beaver Creek toward White River. But my own records and my letters to Janet and other information I've gotten from talking to the other officers, I know that we worked practically all the way to the White River. I don't think we did
well. Well, that snag road is a real...
it's a real definite place.
Yeah.
And this...
That's, you couldn't...
I'm talking about two different things here. One thing is about where the cats met, and the other is giving the 97th credit, because Colonel Pauley gives credit to the Duesenberg brothers for having done everything on the road all the way to the White River. They were following us, and they were a big help to the 97th, because that was the way it was set up for the contractors to assist, because to get the road finished in 1 year. And they built the bridge. I saw them do it at Beaver Creek, a Powell Bridge. And they were fine people. And I knew them at the time. They let us have some of their shacks and so forth. And that's what we had as a cook shack when it was so cold there. And we were there in December. But this is just another sidelight on it. I thought you'd like to have. I'm Walter Mason. And I'm from Lexington, Virginia, where my home today. And in 1942, I was a lieutenant in A Company of the 97th Engineer Regiment when the regiment came to Alaska to build the northern sector of the Alaska Highway, all of the highway that was built by the Army and by the Corps of Engineers. Good beginning?
Right. I was interested last night because you learned that you'd been in the Navy previously. I hadn't known that.
When I got out of high school in 1932, being in Depression days, and my father hadn't died the year before, I enlisted in the United States Navy and served until my 21st birthday in 1936. Which was what the Navy called a minority enlistment, 3 years and 4 months, if you went in before you were 17. And while I was in the Navy, I was a seaman on the USS Northampton, which was a heavy cruiser in those days, and later was an airplane engine mechanic in VS Squadron 3B, the scouting squadron of the USS Lexington, one of our two original big carriers.
And I guess I think that you must have gone to school when you got out of the Navy. Did you do that?
No, nothing. Oh. And that it was while in the Lexington's crew, the incident occurred I told you about, the visiting Pearl Harbor in 1935, and the fleet problem in the Northern Pacific, which made me aware of Alaska in a way I never had been before.
And did you participate in that Aleutian survey?
Yeah, in the Aleutian survey?
Or
no, But to know what I was present, I was an airplane engine mechanic, and our squadrons were flying over as part of this problem. And we did go to Midway Island, and it was the first time any military maneuvers had ever been held at Midway. And we put the Marines in election and went ashore as part of a problem, part of this problem of setting up defense at Midway. All of this came to life very much 5.5 years later at the bombing of Pearl Harbor. And of course, just before that, Midway had been fortified too. And the Japanese, remember in the Battle of Midway, that was one of the main objectives. When I left the Navy in February 1942, I worked in the construction business for a while and entered Virginia Polytechnic Institute in September 1936. And there I was an engineering student, but I was also a member of the Corps of Cadets enrolled in the ROTC program, in the Engineer ROTC program, which I was in for all 4 years I was there. And on graduating from VPI in June 1940, I was commissioned as second lieutenant in the Corps of Engineer Reserve.
When did you marry Janet?
Janet and I had been going together for 2 years before I graduated. And I went to New Jersey and went to work for Wright Aeronautical Corporation, one of the two big engine manufacturers for the Air Force at that time, and civilian too, up in Paterson, New Jersey. And that was in July of 40. And Janet and I were married in on November 9th, 1940. And our first home was up in New Jersey. And last night I mentioned Warwick. That was about 11 months later when that occurred. Janet worked for the New Jersey Bell Telephone Company in the billing office in Paterson, New Jersey. And I was at Wright Aeronautical as a test engineer, in a training program, until Pearl Harbor came along. And that's when my deferred status was canceled. Otherwise, I would have probably been called up to active duty in 1941 earlier. Most of the others weren't in that status. And then I got active duty and went on active duty at Fort Belvoir, March 5th, 1942.
I was amazed that you had very little time on the ground before they shipped you out.
3 weeks. Only 3 weeks from a... Well, it's a little bit more than that. March 5th until it was 3 weeks till I joined the 97th and found out we were going to leave. So it was really about 5 weeks from the time I went on active duty until we were on our way to Alaska.
And I thought you described well how the troops had a clue about where they were going to do that for us.
How what?
How the enlisted men began to understand where they were going, although they couldn't tell them. You knew.
We knew, and I'm sure some of the senior sergeants in the company knew. But it couldn't have been kept from them because of its communications in headquarters, dealing with us moving out and where we're going and what the whole thing. And I'm sure some of the enlisted men, but in general they didn't know. But they didn't know we were going to a northern climb. But strangely enough, it didn't seem to bother them. That. When you're in the military, you get conditioned to whatever comes.
And most of your men been in service for a while when you joined the 97th?
These men, I've checked the record. I've got, incidentally, I've got a roster. One I got from personnel records. I think I gave you a copy.
Yes, you did.
And the men, the names are all in there. That was in December after we went back to the States. But most of the men of the that were up here on that list, in fact, they all. And if you look at that list, you'll find that it gives an enlistment date on that. And it appears to me most of them were enlisted in from February, March, April, in early 1941.
Could you describe the general makeup of your troops, some of the printed materials that a lot of them didn't get much chance at education? What percentage do you think had a decent education?
I would say 15-20% of them were high school graduates. Excuse me. Sorry about this. Go on. I suppose the records were there, but I never did remember looking at them. But the majority of them, you've talked to a lot of them, haven't you? What about the ones you've talked to?
Well, I've got a real mix.
Yeah. I know two down in North Carolina. You gave me the names up near Fayetteville, Clinton, North Carolina. Well, those are just little wide places in the road. And that's either that or small farms or is where the majority of them came from. Now, Refined Sims is from Philadelphia, and I don't know much about his background, but I think he was probably a city boy. And there were a few city boys mixed in there. And I noticed from checking the records, too, that you have a copy of, that there were a few, and I never realized this before, there were a few that were not draftees. There's a few that looks to me that have been volunteers. And Sergeant Hill, who was a top sergeant, what do they call him, the master sergeant of the whole regiment, he was an old-time Army man. And later he was transferred out of that job and became Master Sergeant for A Company alone. Somewhere I think he wasn't performing or something, but anyway, he still maintained his sergeantship.
The men told me that the old-time black officers were worse than the white officers who were racist.
Well,
this... They resented the younger men who had education.
This, I'm talking about a sergeant now, not an officer.
Okay.
He was a... Top kick of the, you know, you call this first sergeant. First sergeant is what you call him in the company. He was made first sergeant of A Company, but he'd been master sergeant for the whole regiment. But he was hard as nails on the men, I mean, like that. Which, in a way, they needed discipline. But I think he was fair, but at the same time, we could not have run the regiment without good non-coms. You can't operate an army without.
Because they were all black.
All the non-coms. The only people that were white were the officers. But the non-coms, the upper non-coms, the sergeants, are and the corporals, they are the ones that run the army. Like there's an old time saying that in the Navy, the chiefs run the Navy, the chief petty officers. Well, in the Army, the top kicks or top sergeants of the Army run the army, and they are the ones that train green second lieutenants when they come on duty. We had some excellent sergeants. These men, some of them not having that much education, yes, but when you get a group together like that, you'll find a lot of natural leadership, and they are the ones that become the sergeants and the corporals. Not only do they have to have leadership, but they have to be loyal and show their loyalty. And it isn't a case of just supporting the officers, it's a case of dealing fairly with the situation and also having skills.
During the period you were out on the Elkhorn, it became possible for a black man to go to officers training school. Did any of your people actually go?
We had one to go, and I can't give you all the details, but I know at least one applied and was sent out of the regiment. Now, there may have been others, but I'm aware of one. And there may have been several applications, but had to clear a lot of hurdles. But it was still difficult this time for him to get into officer training school, and I suppose part of it was the educational background and all that.
The Reverend Carroll got fired because his, down the line, the guys would put in the applications and the top white leadership wouldn't send them any.
Wouldn't send them through?
Yeah.
I don't remember any resistance of that type.
You got somebody in, obviously.
Type in the 97. I'm not saying everything was perfect. And I'm not even saying that all the officers in the outfit had the same attitude I did. But in general, all the company officers, the lieutenants and the captains, I think had a very good attitude towards
me. What was your attitude when you went? I mean, a lot of men didn't want black command. They felt that they had been slighted and they fought it.
Let me mention something to you. You may or may not have heard. When I went on active duty at Belvoir, part of the orientation which went through was to fill out a paper which analyzed preferences and a whole lot of them, a lot of questions. And one of the questions on this, what is your attitude towards serving with black troops? And I put down something like this. It may not be my first choice, but I wouldn't object to it. Because I realized that, when I filled that paper out, I'd already been assigned to at Belvoir, when I went on active duty, I was assigned to what they call an ERTC, it's Engineering Replacement Training Center, which was training recruits, just like the ones in the 97th had been there maybe, 9 months before that. And I'd already been assigned to a black training battalion. And a good, I don't remember what percentage, but I expect half of the training battalions at Belvoir at that time were black. And they had white officers train them, but they were black non-coms in these training battalions. It was a cadre. You know what a cadre is? A cadre in the Army or Navy or so forth. It's a group of people that are set up to train, and they stay there, and the people come through. And there was a good cadre of black non-coms there training the troops. And of course, there was still this segregation, white officer, black officer was going on. And I don't know whether there was ever a setup in the Army where during the war, and there may have been, where there were training groups that were all black, like black officers. I doubt if there were.
Did you, in the early records, in Washington, it was pretty darn clear that these black troops were supposed to stay home, man the docks, and do housekeeping. Was there any talk, did anybody talk about, I mean, this was a strategic assignment, the LCAN, was there any talk about how risky it was to have black troops take on an assignment like that?
Well, let's back up a little bit. You've read Heath Pritchard's book. You read all of it?
Uh-huh.
You have. Well, Heath deals with this subject. When the Alaska Highway was set up in March 42, and maybe before that, maybe in February, there were four regiments. I can't name them all right now, but the 18th was one of them. 341st was one. There were four all white regiments. Two of them are combat regiments. 18th was one of them. Assigned to build the Alaska Highway. And let's just deal with the knowing then. 18th's job was to start at Whitehorse, coming up on the White Pass Railroad to Whitehorse, and start building toward the border, and meet the contractor moving out of Delta. Well, somebody got to looking at the map and realized that they had set an impossible task. Another thing happened. The original plan on building the Pioneer Road and the Alaska Highway was to take 2 years to do it in. And there were some people said it never could be done at all, but the plan, the idea was 2 years. And then with the buildup of the Japanese increasing in the Pacific and everything going on, the pressure came, that's too far off. We have to do this in 1 year. So then they looked around for additional regiments or engineer troops to come up here to build the highway, and there weren't any white groups. They'd been assigned to the Pacific or to Europe or whatnot. This was early in the year. Not too much of that assignment, but there was long-range plans already being underway, and there just weren't any white regiments available to send up here to supplement the four that had already been assigned up here. That's when the 97th, the 95th, and the 35th Engineer Regiments were assigned to the Alaska Highway.
Were you aware that this was regarded as an experiment when you took on your assignment?
No. I'll admit that the officers of the 97th wondered, well, how will we make out with black men in the Arctic? I mean, a lot of people did that. I mean, it's just a natural thing, I mean, to think of. Although, if you've gone back and realized that a black man went with Perry to the North Pole in 1909, well, but you didn't think like it. In other words, what? Send black men up to the Arctic to work on a road? Well, we didn't know what conditions were, and a lot of those people in Washington doing this, they didn't know the total situation up there. General Hogue came up and had to survey the road, but in general, the Corps of Engineers that had taken on an assignment, they didn't have all the answers to either. It was a job to be done, and then we have to play it as we go along. Anyway, these three regiments were assigned to it, but the 97th was the last group assigned up here. These other two regiments, the 95th and the 35th, were assigned. Sometimes must have been early March, but the 97th, see, I didn't join it until the last day of March. But I don't think it had been finalized that the 97th was coming up here until Colonel, what am I trying to say?
Butner,
no, I know that. Colonel, I'm talking about the CO of the 97th. My memory can jump on me sometimes. Anyway, I'll get it in a minute. I don't think until he went to Washington. He was in Washington when I joined the regiment on about the 29th of March. And I don't think until he went up there, it had been finalized that the 97th was even coming up here. It was the latter part of March before we were coming up here. And they were making their plans, and they had to make them as they go along. And it was realized that there was a big gap in there between what the 18th Engineers could hope to do and the contractors coming out of Delta. And then they looked at the map. Another thing happened about this time. There was no road to Anchorage. You couldn't drive to Anchorage from anywhere up here. The Richland Highway was the only road from Valdez to Fairbanks, and then, of course, we were going up the Live and get up a circle of sorts. But they started to build, and civilians built it in late 41, and in 42, they finished it. The road from Gakona, which now is Van Allen, down to toward Palma. And then what do you do then? You come all the way to Fairbanks and go down there and cut over. So they looked at the map and saw that there should be a connector from where Glen Allen is now, to a better spot on the Alaska Highway. So that's when it came along to build the road from Solana to the Tanana River. Tote didn't exist then. That came later. But so they looked at it and said, let's put the 97th up there, let them start at Solana, build to there, and build to the border, and let the contractors build a segment from what's now Tote over to here. Now, it's been said by some that the regiments were brought up here. I know General Buckner was his attitude, and I've read it and heard a little about it later after that. When we came up here, though, the junior officer, the ones lower, certainly in battalion level or maybe the regimental level, did not know this attitude of the top brass in Alaska, or that General Marshall himself didn't believe in sending black troops to the northern country. In general, the officers didn't know that. We also didn't realize or think about it, and I still don't think it's that way, being given an assignment that would take us away from civilization, away from settlements of white people, anything like that. It worked out that way, but I don't think it was specific.
You are specific in his papers.
Whose?
Bucknell.
Oh, yeah. Well, two different things were taking place here. Bucknell didn't have all the influence. If he did, he probably would have kept him from coming up here at all.
Right, exactly.
But we had a fight with Bucknell all the way through building the highway. And not only Bucknell, but O'Connor. O'Connor was the worst. As far as we were concerned, I'm not putting them down, but they weren't that much help to us. And I'll mention something to you about O'Connor later on, because he played a part in our regiment before we were back to the States. We were up here under the chief engineer's office and under White Horse, the Northwest Service Command, and we were in Buckner's territory. But Buckner didn't have control of us. I think the chief engineers, which was Sturdivant, he wasn't chief, he was assistant chief, and I forget who the chief was right then. But I think they said, we got a job to do, and we're going to do it our way.
Right, and what they did was they cleverly picked an assignment where you didn't have to engineer the troops out of town. There was no town, that's why you were there.
Well, the only point I'm making is that somebody had to do these spots, and I'm going to give you another approach to it. I think they knew when they signed the 97th up here that it was a tough assignment.
I was wondering if we look through history, and I think Twitchell maybe can answer this for us, if any black regiment had ever had that much responsibility at that point in the war. I suspect not.
I don't think so. I tell you, we had more Lael than the outfits down the line, and we'll tell you why. They all had a different line of supply. And they were all close to the center of operations. If you study how those regiments worked and so forth. Now, what was it, the 35th? One of them that came in and had to move their troops so far over the Peace River and then up into the interior. I reckon it was the 35th was. That was a tough assignment. But they still had more contact. There was more cohesion in this operation from White Horse down than there was from White Horse's way. And on the 18th, 18th didn't have a tough assignment that we had in one way. It wasn't until they got almost up to the border that they hit permafrost. Twitchell points that out. They got to the Donzac River. In fact, I want to give you this letter that Paulie wrote, and that came to me from Twitchell. I'd never heard of it before. Wrote to General Sturdivant. And it outlines this, and it shows you that the 18th didn't meet a lot of the obstacles we met until later on. They also started up from White Horse all the way up to Kewanee, I think it was, with an old road there that they paralleled and that they could get their supplies over and so forth and spread out. Our big problem, you heard me tell it last night, and is that we started at Solana and we went up through a pass. Well, there wasn't any way to get anything in there. And the colonel made a mistake. I'm not blaming him. He probably needed more help, but he was tended to be a college professor type. He'd been teaching at ROTC at UCLA, but and some of those ROTC people that rotated him were okay, but he was reserve. But
this is the guy that started with you.
Yeah,
he wasn't kind of laid off the
yeah,
job.
Yeah, he wasn't a field man. He wasn't. Wasn't a gung-ho character like Lionel Robinson was when he took the regiment over. But we fooled around there from June 7th up until August 7th, about that early in August, and it only moved about 30 miles. We'd gotten up to Mineral Lake, if you know where that is. General Sturdivant and General Ho came up and landed on Lake Mantasta in the seaplane out of White Horse, and I was the one that drove them up down the road. I didn't hear them talking what they said. But anyway, after looking it over and seeing how poorly we were doing, that's when, why can't I say this? The colonel, this RCO was relieved. I apologize. I don't have anything hit upon me. But anyway, Colonel Robinson took over, and they assessed the situation. Now, I don't know whether they told Colonel Robinson how to what to do, or he figured it out, but somebody figured it out. And all of a sudden we had a turnabout, and Andrew McMakin and I took off in, with the two sleds and two cats, like I told you last night, and went up to Tope, drove all night. I drove the cat most of the way at night myself. It was better than just sitting there riding. So I actually, we were just pulling the sled. We just cleared enough to keep the sled.
And
we,
there wasn't no existing road.
No, no, it wasn't anything. Nothing. The old Eagle Trail cut through there somewhere.
That's
we
a long far. Distance. From
well, it was 15 miles from Mineral Lake to, or Meadow. We crossed a little tote. I have a memento at home of that trip because I had my foot locker full of my clothes and stuff sitting right in the front of that sled, and there was slat. The space between the logs and the sled, a pole went through it, went all the way through my foot locker. Also, when we forded the little Toke River, well, my stuff got wet. It dried out. That's just part of the part of life in Alaska. Anyway, we'd been told to go up there, cross it, little Toke, and head for the Tanana River. Of course, Major Mitchum was already out front locating the road. But we made such a big jump, we started to override him, you know. And that's why I said that night, I sat on the cat and pointed where I thought the Tanana River was and located probably a couple miles of road that way. But another thing that Heath Pitchell, I'd forgotten until just recently, he dug it out somewhere. Because we'd made such a big jump ahead, we didn't have any oil or supplies or anything. They actually put a boom across the behind us, the one the company, BSC, did it, on the Toke River, the little Toke River, and hauled that upstream up above it. They could get into that and floated it down. You remember that in Pitchell's book? Floated it down so we would have some oil and supplies to keep moving toward the Tanana.
Well, was there any way to get anything from Delta to Toke at that point? Just flying?
Delta.
Delta North of
there? Oh, no. Well, there was a river. I mentioned the riverboat came up later, and if somebody had planned it ahead of time, but Toke, there wasn't any road from Toke to the river at this point.
Right.
This
and was there was no road from Toke to Delta, the 97th, other divisions.
Oh, there wasn't anything.
That came
later. There wasn't anything. At this point, there was nothing. I don't know. Well, I don't think the Duesenbergs had started at Delta Junction yet, working east. They were just moving in because it wasn't until after we crossed the river on the 18th. I can be off a day or two there, but I've called it the 18th, studying my letters to Janet and little things I wrote her. And they moved in on the 25th, came up our road.
The Duesenbergs?
One of the Duesenberg brothers. There was two brothers. And one of them was at Delta, and the other one was behind, came in behind us. See, I have had communication with the Duesenbergs, and they were wanting to know more about their relationship with the 97th. And I wrote them a whole lot. And but they came in on the 25th. They actually thought they came and were pushing us, but they didn't. I was already headed up the river with the point detachment of A Company when they got in. And they came into Toke, set up a camp, and then started working toward the other group that were coming down from Delta Junction. And
was
they eventually
there anything at Toke? Was there an airfield?
Nothing.
Nothing.
Well, there was an airfield over at Tanana Cross. They're still there. A small flight.
Okay, but nothing at Toke.
There was not. Toke was just a big plain there with a lot of trees in it. And we cut that 8 mile tangent down there, and where that stopped. Major Mitchum had laid it out to that point. You see, it was known that was the point. They'd already planned it from aerial photographs, that's the point they wanted the Glen Highway to hit the Alaska Highway.
I want you to go back a little bit and tell us how you went across country on the train, and then you came in at Valdez and kind of worked your way up, just a chronological how you came into Alaska in the first place.
Well, we boarded the train on the night of April 15th. Janet was fortunate enough to go with Captain Sanders and his wife over to the train, and I bid her goodbye at the train. And when we got on there, we had a car, baggage car, we converted into a kitchen. And the men were all given bunks, two men to the bottom bunk, head to foot, you know, and one in the upper. The officers had compartments, in the end of the train, McMickens and I shared a compartment together. And everybody had a bunk, and we took off the LNN across Alabama and Tennessee and Kentucky, I remember riding up through that, and eventually to Evansville, Indiana, across the river and into St. Louis. And at St. Louis, our troop train was turned over to the Union Pacific Railroad, and we headed west. It took us 4 days to go from Pensacola to Fort Lewis, right outside Tacoma, Washington.
And how was morale?
The morale on the train was good. We had wondered if the men would try to, some of them would try to desert, not knowing where they're going, and so forth. But we had pretty good food on there. We had stocked B rations, Army B rations, which means canned goods and staples and stuff. And I was mess officer for the company. In fact, there wasn't anybody for A Company there, something recognized. So somebody, I had to be everything. We would have the conductor wire ahead and give us fresh rations and even ice cream at some station ahead, and we'd take it aboard. So we ate good going across. That was part of the strategy. I reckon it was good.
And did any trucks do
that? Nobody left the train. We, this was the 1st Battalion only. The 2nd Battalion came on another train, and I think the headquarters group came with the 2nd Battalion. And there was nothing. I think the men enjoyed the trip. Most of them have never seen, certainly never seen the West. They traveled from their homes up to Fort Belvoir and maybe back down to Florida. But they hadn't, and it was an adventure for them. And they were happy and played cards, and some of them had musical instruments. And that prevailed all the way through our whole project. I mean, the men knew how to adapt and make themselves satisfied. Now, you're probably only as aware of this as I am. I'm a Southerner, and black people at that time, certainly, and I'd say it's just some of this is inherent. They know better about how to make themselves happy under adverse circumstances, oftentimes, than white people. Are you aware of that? Okay, your studies and all this have made you aware of that, I'm sure, if you weren't already. And I think...
I've been dirt poor myself, sir.
Okay.
I think it goes with being dirt poor sometimes.
Yeah, well, that's part of it. It's because they've never been used to much. There's another side to this whole thing about black troops coming into the Army and so forth. These men have been grown up with very little on farms and so forth. Very poor economic circumstances. This was right after the Depression. The Depression wasn't over. The World War II ended the Depression, and times were still hard, particularly in the South. Cotton wasn't doing so well, and crops and so forth. Anyway, it was a step up for these men to be in the Army. And not only that, they were given something definite to do, and they were increasing their skills all the way along. And I think the thing that may have not been dealt with in all this is that, and you've talked to more of these people than I have, I think that in general, position of the soldiers that were in the Army was lifted, and they had skills when they left here, like a cat driver. Well, that skill could be converted, and the mechanics we had, and the carpenters, and the cooks, and all these other people, and I'm sure that the economic level of the troops after the release from the Army was, and their ability to make a living was way above what it was when they came in.
Being a Southerner, had you worked with black people before you got this assignment?
I grew up in a village. My father was a building contractor in Roanoke, Virginia. He came up the hard way too. He didn't have much education, but he worked up to a company, a corporation. He actually had as a partner, an architect who had graduated from MIT. My father didn't hardly get out of grade school. And we lived out in the country, and there were a lot of black families scattered around this country. It wasn't predominantly black, but there were, I can even tell you the name of one family, the Baileys is one, Tyree is another. See, I can remember back those families. And I had contact with those families. My grandfather had a farm out from Roanoke in another direction, and he made a living for these five children out of this 100-acre farm. But the adjoining farm was a family by the name of Franklin, and they were a black family. And there was contact back and forth. It wasn't complete social contact, but it was still the point where this Mrs. Franklin would come down to my grandmother's house and sit down in the kitchen and have a cup of coffee and talk over. So I had been exposed on this basis all my life. Now, we didn't go to school together or anything like that, but my father employed a number of black men and paid them the same wages for the same work he paid white men. And there was a division, but there was still a mutual respect between families, and there was occasions when each helped the other out. Have you ever heard anything like this before?
Just neighbors.
Neighbors, not full social neighbors, but still neighbors that helped each other. And that still goes on in the South. And then when I went to school, city schools, after I got out of elementary school, there wasn't that much contact within the city. But at the same time, race relations, the black people all lived in one part of Roanoke, but there was pretty good race relations between the two groups. I don't know whether I do it in all cases now, but I wasn't afraid to walk through any part of the black part of town alone when I was a young boy.